You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. The topic for episode number two is, What Can I Know?, focusing on René Descartes' first and second meditations. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, currently situated in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Pask, and I'm in Austin, Texas.
And this is Wes Allwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
Welcome, welcome. So the ground rules for our discussion to be revised for future episodes contingent upon our whims are, number one, we do not assume that our audience knows anything about this. You do not have to have read the Descartes that we will be discussing today. If you have, your experience will be all that more gratifying for you. Number two, no gratuitous name dropping. We are interested in ideas, not with fetishizing a bunch of dead philosophers. If we have a point to make, just make it. Can't say, you know, you'll understand what I mean if you go read The Tao of Marmaduke by Hieronymus T. Leinsgrab. Number three, we shall be rigorous and exact in all that we say, except in the case where not doing so seems like it would be more entertaining.
Huzzah.
Yay.
So we've gotten a little listener feedback since last episode. I should also mention that you can look at partiallyexaminedlife.com or iTunes to get this first episode, and there will be a link on there to a Facebook group which will have actual discussion topics. So if people listen to this and they're inspired to want to talk to us, talk back to us, to talk to some other fellow listeners, they can get on there and tell us how full of crap we are.
Wow.
Or how awesome we are. Or both. So we had one person, we only had a couple people actually listen to this, number one, before working on this, purposefully, in case it was just too hideous. And so one of them was Dylan, my brother-in-law, who works at St. John's University, who we referenced in the podcast as being cool, and he was just fine with the level of detail. So professionals in the field, welcome. We are aiming ourselves just at you. And to quote from his email, he says, I think that whichever tutor gave Wes the evil eye regarding his current work ought to be skewered with a shard chipped off the ivory tower standing in their office. But then we also got another piece of feedback from one of your friends, Seth, right? Who is not a philosophy person, who had only taken a philosophy course or two in college and thought that this was completely followable, even without having read the reading or knowing anything about any of this, right?
Yes, and this is somebody who consciously and actively talks about how much she hates reading.
So people who hate reading, this podcast is aimed specifically at you.
I should be more specific. She hates reading fiction or this type of thing. She likes to read like professional books, like for her field, which is actually social work. So I thought if she was entertained and could follow it, then I would think that would capture quite a bit of sort of what we would consider the non-traditional philosophy audience, or a not typical philosophy audience.
We should clarify for our listeners what our history is. That is, we all went to the University of Texas at Austin Philosophy Grad School in the Clinton years for far too long, but then did not stick in that for the duration, for the rest of our lives.
With dropouts.
Yeah, pretty much. So this at least was my first reading for this, the first podcast, and for this one was probably my first philosophy reading in a while. I think the last thing I tried to read before this, just a couple weeks before this, was an article in the University of Michigan graduate newsletter or something, which I got through about a page. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Why am I wasting my time on this? And stopped. So going back to this, my personal experience at least was, I guess, at the same time getting sucked in the way that I remember being so long ago, but then also being repulsed at the same time.
You should clarify that you were repulsed because of the specific reading and not because of the activity of reading.
Well, I read all the time. It's a matter of reading philosophy. It's a matter of reading something. Like the kind of books that I read now, I read mostly fiction, and for the most part, they're things designed to be read, right? They're for the benefit of an audience. They might be a little artsy. They might have a lot of internal value to them, such that the person writing it was enjoying it, was getting something out of it, was exploring some new territory maybe. but they were still sculpted such that a reader would be enticed to want to read more. There is a recognition among writers nowadays that your readers will not put up with any sort of shit that you throw at them, that you actually have to appeal to them in some way. Whereas these guys are all asking you to a greater or lesser extent to just bear with me, follow my thoughts a little.
And, Mark, you've really been corrupted by your career in communications.
There's it's such an insane...
Who's the audience for this? Anyway, sorry, Seth.
No. I'm taken aback by the just barely veiled rage and anger that Mark brings to the table. It excites and frightens me at the same time.
At the same time, I gotta say, I was enjoying it. I'm like, well, I should be doing this more often, at least, going back to some of the classics. And so we will. But I'd find myself, for instance, just to jump ahead a little bit, thinking about when reading Descartes here, thinking about, what does Descartes think about the unconscious? And then cutting myself off to say, well, that's exactly the kind of bullshit question that scholars in this area would get themselves pulled into and waste a lot of time on. Because really, is Descartes going to be illuminating about this concept of the unconscious? Is he going to be? Because you could take any philosopher and to check whether you how well you understand that philosopher, ask what they think about some subject that they do not explicitly talk about. Well, usually, if they didn't explicitly talk about it, it's because they don't have anything they wanted to say about it. but you could spend all day sort of reaching beyond. Oh, their worldview is so complete that they must have had something to say. What would Descartes say about Seinfeld? Would he have been down with that? Would he have followed it all the way into season 8?
But more importantly, was he gay?
Okay.
I'm thinking of several biographies. Dressing, for instance, was Lincoln gay? There's this idea that the...
What?
Oh, of course. Yeah. You haven't heard that?
Oh, yeah.
He, slept with a dude for several years. In the same
way. This is all hypothetical in the same way, and it's because if you've run out of interest in the Civil War, if you think there's been so much written about it and you despair of making a name for yourself as a scholar, then you can move on to other more interesting subjects.
Wow. Well, I got to tell you, I'm coming from a totally different place than either one of those.
Was Descartes a cannibal?
No. So first off, just to kind of address, my little origin story, I don't see us as dropouts. I believe we were career redirected. I think that's the way I would put it. I took a good measured, reasoned break from the doing of philosophy and grad school and, decided that the alternative was more attractive to me. But what I find interesting about coming back now is how literary these texts are to me, and how before I used to read them just for the argument and the logic. And when I read this next time, I was absolutely delighted to reread Descartes. And I went back and I actually read the preface to the reader.
Sure.
Because to me, it's completely absurd. It was hilarious, that he writes this preface to the doctors, the theology of the college or whatever of the church. And it's like, it seems to me that the proof for the existence of God really should be owned by philosophy and not theology, because we really need a good argument to convince infidels. I laughed out loud when I read that. And I was like, this is going to be awesome. And
that's a good segue into some background for this. And by the way, I was also delighted to read it. I really enjoy it, actually. There weren't mixed feelings as with Mark, although there was a little impatience over the length of some of the passages. But some of the background of this, Descartes was actually worried about being accused of atheism, and so he's making these protestations in large part to show that he's a bona fide religious person. And he still didn't, despite all those precautions he takes, and he still didn't publish it in the Netherlands, where he was living at the time, because he was worried about, again, being accused of being an atheist and getting into trouble. So I think that's part of it. And I think sometimes I suspect that the theological stuff going on in this is less important to Descartes than than it might seem otherwise, that it's sort of window dressing for political reasons, and that so.
Well, can I give my two cents? Can I give a synopsis of the five meditations? So we had assigned, that is the thing that we had said at the end of the last podcast, and that will be on the link, that folks following along in here, you don't have to, but you can read the first two meditations. And those are the ones that we're going to focus on in our discussion. The first meditation covers this method of doubt. So it's the entire philosophical enterprise, which is to say, I've been misled a lot in my past. There are a lot of things that I believed were true that turned out not to be true. So I'm going to start off my brand new philosophical enterprise by trying to doubt everything. The second meditation, okay, now that I've doubted everything and I've dwelt with that for an evening, I'm going to see if I try to doubt everything, is there something that is just indubitable? And he comes to the conclusion there that, well, the fact that I exist, that there is someone doing the doubting, must exist. The third meditation, so that's where we stop. And as far as I'm concerned, that's where the good argumentation stops, though you can dispute me on that. The third meditation covers, well, I know I exist. Is there anything else I can assume that I can prove exists, you know, with absolute deductive certainty? And he comes up with the existence of God using a variation of an old medieval argument for the existence of God that's very lame, and I don't think we really should talk about it in any depth. I think we should have a later episode covering medieval philosophers and things they love to talk about, like their arguments for the existence of God. So everything after this point relies on that very lame proof for the existence of God. The fourth meditation being, is God a deceiver? If God exists and he's all good, well, how do I know he's not deceiving me about a lot of stuff? And then the fifth one, after ever having concluded that he is not a deceiver, is to say, is to prove everything else, right? Is to say, well, since he's not a deceiver, then all the things I think about, you know, that I found science on, these material things, since God tells me that, you know, my senses tell me all the time that there they are, it's sort of like God is telling me these things, and we've shown that God is not a deceiver, we'll just say material objects exist as well. So that's what the fifth and sixth meditations cover. The sixth meditation goes also into the difference between this mind, right, the I that I've discovered in the second meditation exists, and body, right, the material things that in the fifth meditation I've discovered existed. That's a pretty good sum up.
Yeah, I think we're done.
Who would like to start us on what is so ungodly important about meditations one and or two?
Well, let me go ahead. There were a couple things about this that I thought were really interesting, at least to start off. In some ways, I'm really fascinated by this concept that, you know, he says, I traveled a lot when I was a youth, and I went to all these foreign lands, and I sort of learned that things that I thought were true weren't. It's basically, he talks about how his experience and being exposed to other cultures and things like that helped sort of disabuse him of prejudices or ideas that he learned in his, you know, his own. But then even further, he's essentially retired, right? And he's suggesting that this activity of doing philosophy is a reflective activity that's better reserved for the mature, the, you know, the retired, the old, that now that he's filled his life full of experience, he can sit back and actually do philosophy. And, you know, I was just thinking in terms of comparing that to the idea of going to school like we did when we were, you know, in our 20s, and this idea that there are so many other things that are reserved for the young, but he's basically saying, I couldn't do my good thinking until I had lived my life and done all the things I was going to do. And now that I'm retired and I'm sitting in front of the fire and kind of drowsing off to sleep and smoking a pipe, I can
He puts a parenthetical in there, and now that he has no bodily passions.
Yes.
Which is very interesting.
Now, I always found my bodily passions to make me a better thinker, but...
That reminds me, actually, there was a... at the college I went to this place called Reed College, which was kind of a hippie school, but also very intense academically, and there was... At one point in time, people were circulating T-shirts that said it was the Reed College Celibacy Society, and the motto was, and I don't know Latin, so I'm not going to claim that this is correct, but caelibus iusque studiarum, or something along those lines, like celibacy in order that we may study. Totally irrelevant. Sorry.
No, it's relevant.
But the idea that you have to live your life and then stop living it in order to do philosophy, I found fascinating. How's that sound? We'll leave it at that.
Well, he also did a lot of his philosophy in bed, right? And I'm not making that up. That he used to spend the entire morning in bed, sitting around, you know, writing his philosophy, reading his philosophy. And this is, in fact, one of the most, the points of Descartes' life that I found most inspiring, that is, I have referenced it most in my everyday life, is the way he finally died, which is he got a new job that made him get up in the morning consistently, and he wasn't used to doing that, and it screwed up his immune system, and he died. So getting up early in the morning is ungodly and will kill you.
Yeah, it was a tutoring job, I think.
Yes.
Even worse.
For the Swedish the Swedish princess.
He made his living as a live-in tutor for kids, basically. So.
Okay. So let's get on. No. I find this to be a very personal and very, it's one of my favorite texts because I think it's something that speaks to, you know, the average person can read this and say, like, I totally get what he's saying, right? Like, sometimes I fall asleep and I think I'm awake and I am in this half dreaming state. And, you know, I just think there's a lot of really nice little images in it. And I especially like the fact at the end of the first meditation, he goes, oh, but now I'm tired. Time to go to bed. Like, why even write that down? Why not just end the first meditation and start? And it's like, oh, ay, my back.
Because yeah, it's very personal for a philosophical treatise. And of course, that's intentionally so. And it sort of goes towards what he's trying to demonstrate or talk about. But it is because it's like a diary at the same time.
Yes. Okay.
Right, I think that's a natural state for philosophy. This is how, you know, why I had such trouble for a long time writing philosophy papers, because actually, contrary to what I was just saying about philosophy in general, when you write a philosophy paper now that's to be published, you just revise the bejesus out of it. Like, you can't have a sort of stream of consciousness account of your own brilliant thoughts. Even though that's the starting point, that's what you start writing. You really have to have something that's broken down into very defined steps. And if you can chart the damn thing out in formal logic, all the better.
Right.
But a lot of these classic philosophers that we read, like, well, I don't think Descartes is the prime example of this, but certainly Nietzsche and some of the others, you know, were much more like that. You know, you have to be much more patient with them and follow their thoughts as they were just brimming out of their brilliant minds.
Yeah, and I think this is part of what we confronted at the University of Texas, which is the professionalization of philosophy and what that means. It's one thing to love philosophy and then to have that personal attachment to it. It's another to become a professional and to have to do the sort of things that go along with that, some of which are not necessarily that intellectually honest, like scrubbing papers of personal references to oneself and of anything personal in order to make it seem objective or scientific. And yet when I read someone like Descartes, it is refreshing that he's willing to be so personal. He doesn't have to pretend to be this very professional scientist or academic philosopher.
Well, yeah, he makes a point of not referring to other texts, which is the big thing that makes it so hard and annoying to write philosophy professionally, that you can't just have an original thought. You have to say what existing thoughts in the literature it relates to. So it requires much, you know, you have some germ of an idea, and then you have to go research everybody that has thought anything about that, and you realize that your idea is kind of pathetic compared to a lot of the things out there, and you end up just writing a critique of some or synthesis of stuff that already is out there. And, you know, maybe after you've written your fifth book, you'll get to put in an actual original thought.
I'm pretty sure that the last original thought in philosophy happened sometime just after the Second World War, and that we've just basically been rehashing things since.
Or that everything is a footnote to Plato, to quote an unnamed, to quote a philosopher who I won't name.
All right. So let's. I want to get right at this idea that he starts off saying that everything that he knows, he's received through his senses. Right. That basically
does he
everything
say everything or just a lot of the stuff that I think that I know most certainly comes through my senses? Because a lot of things he knows because he's been told by people. It's not everything he knows.
I think that's a good question. I think he says something like, all that I have learned, all that I have up to this moment accepted as possessed of the highest truth and certainty, I received either from or through the senses.
Sure.
Right. He's saying that the senses, that the natural assumption is that our perceptions of things outside of us are the most certain things, and that internal reflections are, in fact, very murky.
Yeah, okay, so seeing is believing. If somebody tells me something, maybe I don't believe it until I do the logic or, you know, see it for myself.
Yeah, and I think it's even a little bit there's more to it than that, in that he's saying like that there's a certain kind of visceral experience or a visceral nature of experience that makes it so sure for you, like. How, you know, I'm sitting right here. I can't doubt that I'm sitting here in a chair in front of the fire. I can't doubt if it's raining outside or if the sun is shining or if the, you know, trees are green. Like, that's just got this concrete, visceral reality, right? And that this is going to be critical in a little bit later when he talks about dreaming, right? That another fascinating point for me. But that he says you can hardly be sure of anything more so than you can be sure of the fact that you have a body and that the body gets cold or warm and that you see things and all that kind of stuff, right?
Sure.
Okay. And then he says, but then he immediately, you know, so first off, I guess the question is, do you guys believe that? Like, I mean, as a premise, as a starting premise to say, like, maybe we've lived, you know, the 300 years since Descartes and this has been rehashed a million times and all that, and now people don't have the same kind of confidence, but do we have any kind of context for why he would make that statement and whether people would believe it? I think a lot of people would. I mean, if a lot of people are, you know, I'm from Missouri, show me, right?
Well, he's going to, of course, where we're leading with this, he's going to reject that, right? He's saying it seems that way. That's the kind of thing that seemed to me to be the case. But by the end of the second meditation, and sort of caps off the second meditation, is the idea that, in fact, my awareness of myself, something that might seem very murky, is in fact much more certain than my awareness of those objects. But of course, that's the sort of ending conclusion. Is it so? Just to get at Seth's question, is it that our natural propensity to think that those sort of sensory perceptions are the most certain?
Do you have to buy that in order for him to launch this whole thing? And if so, is it something that you can buy?
Well, and it would be interesting to think about how, if that's not our natural propensity, you know, just the seeing is believing, which I do think is certainly, you know, pretty prominent in our intuitions. But how much, if we disagree with that, if we think, you know, there's some sort of inner reflection is giving us things more immediately, how much is that due to Descartes' influence itself? You know, because it just can't be underestimated how much this affected Western philosophy, you know, even before it was an arcane, very focused discipline for the very few, you know, when it was still influencing popular culture. So his ideas are definitely out there. The other thing is the scientific method was not yet developed by this time. So, you know, if you're asking somebody, you know, what's going to prove to you that something is true, you're not necessarily going to say, well, I have to see it with my own eyes. Because now we have this whole cultural thing of, you know, scientific theories. How do I know about the speed of light or the laws of thermodynamics? It's not because, you know, I see them illustrated with my eyes. We might not even really, unless we know enough about science, know how some of these laws are, like which laws instantiate which things. Yet, if somebody tells us, oh yeah, there's these Newton's three laws of motion, we're probably going to accept them as truth if these are part of the scientific canon that it's been approved for several hundred years, because these are well confirmed by experiments. Actually, three laws of motion are a terrible example, because those are things you can confirm right now by dropping things and pushing them around. But certainly that goes for other.
Well, not the law of inertia, actually.
But you're not confirming. I mean, you wouldn't be confirming the laws. You'd just be confirming your experience of the fact that when you drop something, it goes down instead of up. Like, I'm more sure of the fact that I have a black car than I am that the size of a celestial body is like directly proportional to its gravitational pull.
No, you are exactly right. I don't think that's the way people see. Like, if you ask people, you know, what is the law of gravity? How do you prove gravity? Well, I drop this thing, it falls. I've proven gravity. Now, of course, that's not all there is to gravity. You just stated what the exact law of gravity is, but maybe there's a popular version and the scientific version of that. I'm not sure if this is entirely relevant, but I'm trying to get at, you know, what feeds into our intuitions about what we know. I think also, whether it's historically after that, I think the notion of faith is pretty key in our intuitions of these things. Some people believe in it, some people don't. But if you just ask somebody, you know, which things are the most certain to you, a good percentage of them are going to say, you know, the things that I take on faith.
True. This is sort of the advent of modern science and empiricism. So it's in that vein, this idea that knowledge comes from the senses, right? And so there is that influence, and that is sort of a common sense prevailing idea, I think, in our society. But at the same time, when you ask them, what are you most certain about? I think you're right, Mark. People are going to be inclined to talk about whether it's religious faith or quote-unquote values and things like that.
You know, maybe this could just be a rhetorical device that we're getting hung up on or something like that. But I think the key is, you know, that he's saying, you know, I think the average person would put a lot of stock that their perception of the world and what they learn from their senses and their, you know, their knowledge therefrom is pretty solid. And what he's saying is, but we know that sometimes we can be misled, right? Like, you look at something from a distance and you think it's blue, but it's really green, or, you know, like the concept of an oasis where you have kind of like a little bit of an illusion. And then more importantly, his critical turn, that you can dream and have dreams that are so real that you can't distinguish them.
Right. So those are two steps of the argument, right? So first he's talking about these things that were in classical philosophy that he was familiar with, of optical illusions. I mean, you mentioned the mirage. There's also, I put a stick or a pencil into water. Wow, it looks bent now, but yet it's not bent. Isn't that the senses are fooling us? And then he imagines a response to that, which is, okay, fine. The senses fool you in certain conditions, like when something is very far away or when light is being refracted through something. But how could it be fooling you about basic things like I'm sitting in this room right now? And that's when he brings up dreaming.
Right. It's his thought process to kind of get to say, well, what if all my perceptions were just completely made up and wrong, right? Or I was completely misled about all my perceptions. But I think there might be some people who would say, like, you know what? There is something qualitatively different between waking states and dream states and sort of basic standard reality that I experience an overwhelming majority of the time and like sticks that are bent in water that make it so that I don't ever doubt that. Like, they could never take that step.
Yeah, I think this is where we get into the whole methodological part of this, which is to say the presupposition of doubt, the idea is to get at a foundation, right? So the idea is to doubt as much as possible, and you could do that by fiat. You could say, well, we know we're wrong sometimes, so let's just assume that we're always wrong. Not because Descartes, and this is something I used to try and tell students at UT all the time, he's not sitting around at night worried to death that the things around him don't really exist. In a way, it's, you know, it's not a, which is why I think he uses that term, methodological doubt. It's really about continuing the Platonic tradition and that we learned about in the last reading, where you try and rid yourself of all your prejudices and your opinions and your preconceptions in order to figure out what you can't rid yourself of, if there is such a thing, what you can call certain, and then to build science systematically on top of that. Part of what he's concerned about, by the way, as more background, is the method of the ancient geometers like Euclid, where you identify, the goal is to identify axioms or premises or
postulates,
presuppositions, and then do propositions based on those axioms. So if anything, the method is meant to distinguish axiom from, let's say, theorem, which is something that's proved from the presupposition, the things that are proven versus the things that we just assume. So that distinction, I think, is important to him. And then just as another bit of background, Descartes had written his own book of geometry where he invented geometry as we know it today, analytical geometry, with and all the stuff that we learn in school, with the grids and the coordinate points and slope and all that tedious stuff. Just to get back to the methodological part, that the idea is to distinguish the things that we're trying to prove from the things that we have to presuppose. And the way to do that is to just chuck everything out, say it's all, we're going to doubt everything that's possible to doubt, and then see what floats up as a foundation.
I just think it's awesome that I don't think a tenth of the people in the world ever in their lifetime would say, like, you know what? Let's just assume that everything that I know and experience is completely made up and all that, you know, like as a process. Yeah. I think it's beautiful. I think it's absolutely beautiful. So there, I said it. I have a man crush on Descartes.
One of the objections that I commonly hear about this, you know, historically, is that people got so caught up in this as a model of doing philosophy that they were blinded to common sense, something like that, which is just to say, you know, the way Descartes does it, of course, is he has this methodology of doubt, but then he is able in the course of his meditations, because God is not a deceiver, to get everything back again, get all of science, everything that he already thought in the first place. But if we think that his argument doesn't work all the way through, then you're left maybe as a serious skeptic, you know, as your final ending point. Well, if we just can't be sure about any of this stuff, that any of the claims of science are true, maybe they're true enough, right? They work for practical purposes.
But in a way, it doesn't matter to science whether there really are things outside of us, because as a system, it still all works. You're looking for consistency. Whether or not it's all an illusion, or let's say, you know, in modern terms, maybe it's all constructed. Maybe the brain is adding space and time to things. Maybe it's just a function of the way we perceive the world. We could come up with, not with relativism, but a sort
of... pragmatism. It's pragmatism. If it works.
You know, idea...
If the scientist is internally consistent.
Right.
And scientists are going to be happy with that. I mean, right? If they just care about following the system and figuring out the next thing in the system, they're going to be fine with that. The average Joe, somebody who wants a philosophically coherent worldview, or who comes at this whole thing from a religious perspective where they really want to know the truth, is not going to be satisfied with that. And so this leads to, you know, existentialism, to maybe there are things we just have to accept on faith, or we just have to face the absurd that we just can't understand any of this, or this, you know, radical skepticism. So you have whole branches of philosophy that go in those directions. And one of the criticisms of Descartes is this methodological doubt in the first place is so artificial and so unmotivated by anything in our actual experience that we shouldn't get caught up in those, you know, settling for, oh, well, as long as the system's internally consistent, or we have to have faith. We shouldn't be caught up settling for that. We should just accept the initial facts of experience, of common sense, as they come to us, because, you know, they want to say, if you really want to see this as more of just a methodological trick that we're doing for the day, and then we're going to, you know, go back to our old way of looking at things, then something has to actually motivate it. So this argument of a dreaming actually has to be good.
See, I think it doesn't end up leading back just to the beginning, though, because I think he wants to reverse that initial idea that it's the things outside of us that are more certain, and that it's perception of oneself or one's soul, as he puts it, that is murky. At the very end of the second meditation, he wants to assert that, in fact, when I perceive, say, the wax or an object outside of me, when I perceive its unity, which cannot simply be derived from the senses, but has to be a matter of a function of the mind, what's more clearly revealed in my perception of objects is not the certainty of the object, because that unity of the object doesn't come in through the senses. What's clear is the unity and the existence of myself. Do you guys remember that from the...
That's
kind of a difficult argument, but I think it's of huge consequence.
No, that's a good point, Wes. I tried to write out the argument for the first two meditations, and that's where the logic gets really convoluted. But there's an interesting point earlier on. It's still in the first meditation. He says he's going through the dreaming piece and about how, you know, even in dreaming, you have things like number and color and shape, right? You know, even if you don't have the same things, you still have those. So, mm-hmm. And he says, but wait a second, whether I remain awake or asleep, 2 + 3 still equals 5. Mm-hmm. And then he says, but you know what? God could make me think that 2 + 3 = 5 when it really doesn't, right? Now, he wouldn't do that because he's all good. But let me just, for the sake of argument, suppose there's a demon, you know, that's deceiving me, right? And that's where he ends it. And he's like, whoa, that's just too much for me to comprehend. It's time to go to sleep. But what's interesting is that he could have led with that. He could have just said, you know, suppose there's a malignant demon that makes me think that everything that I think is true is false. What I see, what I know, but he goes through and does the whole sensory perception thing, I think for a lot of reasons. One is it's easier to comprehend and more readable, and so it's more accessible by certain kinds of readers and thinkers. A second thing is what Mark's point about him trying to doubt and then do some reestablishment, that somehow this ties into that. And then, of course, your point about then also doing the flip from the confidence in the sensory perception to more like the confidence in the self. So I think he has to have done it all on purpose. I'm just saying that.
But it's another reason that he's doing that is he's leading you through different, without mentioning specific names, different ideas about the way we perceive. And so there's a difference, for instance, between raw perception of objects and the role of the imagination in combining all those colors in the dreams. And then the higher level cognitive functions of judgment, where you're putting together 2 + 2 = 4. And so he wants his doubt to extend to all those different realms. You're right, Seth, he could start with the deceiver, because the deceiver covers all of those realms. But I think by separating them out gradually, you get an idea of these different cognitive functions that he thinks are involved in perceiving and thinking.
Yeah, you could imagine this being, instead of written out in prose as he is, you could totally imagine this as like a dialogue, right? Like, suppose, reader, you know, like, you must think that your sensory perception is certain. Yes? Well, yes, I do. But certain, sometimes you are deceived, right? Oh, well, yeah, I guess I am. You know, you can totally get that feel out of it.
Yeah.
I'm in love with this text. What can I tell you?
Me too. But and can I make one more argument, Mark, for the usefulness of the methodology, and it's not merely a trick. And again, it goes to geometry, which is there's a common method of proving propositions in it where you assume the opposite of what you want to prove. It's called reductio ad absurdum, and it's all over geometrical propositions. And it's a very, if you've ever tried study geometry, it becomes the first thing in your toolkit that you try and do, because it's so powerful and oftentimes makes an easy, simple proof. You assume the opposite of what you want to prove, and then you find out that it contradicts some axiom in your system. So here he wants to make that assumption, but it's a very global, it's different in the sense he's not assuming that some specific thing is false, but that everything is false, that we are completely in error. So he's taking the idea of the reductio absurdum and globalizing it. He's making it completely comprehensive and trying to see what follows out of that. So that's a very interesting thing to try and do. So the thing that he assumes, that I'm in error about everything, well, the error itself becomes the knowledge, the thing that you're certain about. And so there's the reductio. If you assume that you're in error about everything, then you must be certain at least about being in error. And of course, that's a recapitulation of what we had in the Apology with Socrates, which is, I can know only one thing, which is that I know nothing. But the knowing of nothing turns out to be a very interesting type of knowledge, let's say. And of course, Descartes makes it very interesting because he gets everything back, Mark, as you pointed out.
One of the subtleties of this that I liked is really another aspect of this personal quality of the essay, that it reads like a journal, which, even though he might be doing something that's like a geometry proof or a mathematical proof, as you're saying, and you know, assuming the opposite of what he wants to prove, what he says what he wants to do is he wants to no longer take as certain the things that he formerly thought were certain, right? But he says, if I just tell myself that, well, I'm really not sure that these physical objects are around me, that's not going to be psychologically convincing enough. So it's not going to get deep enough into my psychology to constitute a real doubt that will give rise to any new interesting thoughts. So he says, I'm just going to assume that they're all not just in doubt. I'm going to assume they're all actually false.
Right.
And the psychological trick that he's playing on himself, and I'm using trick not in a bad sense here, is to say, I'm not really going to believe that these things are false either. I can't get myself to believe that. I mean, it's just going to smack me in the face that, of course, you know, I'm sitting in this chair. But if I tell myself it's false, maybe that'll at least introduce some doubt. Right? So he's assuming the opposite in hopes that his actual psychological beliefs that he is holding, as opposed to what he writes down on the page, will shift a little bit into the doubtful category. And that will be enough to let him self-examine and figure, if I have this doubt of everything, well, what remains? What is certain at that point?
Very well put.
See, I said something nice about it.
Finally.
Yes. I'd like to acknowledge you for sharing that with us, Mark.
But... well, I'll go back to my major critique later. But
now I'd like you to say that you're delighted by it. I'm not going to be satisfied.
All right. Well, let me ask you this thing. Because one of the arguments against this whole procedure or this part of the meditation that I've taken to be have some worth is this challenge of dreaming in particular. And it seems to me that what you guys are saying is that it doesn't even matter if his dreaming argument doesn't work, because it's just a stepping stone to this idea of an evil deceiver telling me that even mathematical truths are wrong, that covers everything. But, you know, if you take that later stuff as sort of a purely abstract thing, and we really want something psychologically motivating to go on here, to give us a real reason to doubt. So, you know, the thing about senses, oh yeah, all right, well, things can be far away. I mean, I can admit that. But that doesn't really pierce at the heart of, you know, of these obvious things that I shouldn't doubt. So he puts a lot of stake, I think, in this dreaming argument, which I think anybody who has thought a lot about dreaming or read or done some self-exploration into conscious states, like as an adult, if you've at least thought about dreaming a good deal, you can usually tell if you're dreaming or not. It doesn't really, I mean, they're qualitatively different things, right? You try to read something
while
you're
dreaming, though.
Oh, yes. While you're dreaming, like if you try to read something in your dream,
yeah,
you'll see it doesn't stay steady. Like you look at it and then you look back on it, it's different.
But usually we don't do that. I used to do something called lucid dreaming, and that was
that's exactly what I'm talking about.
But you have to make a conscious effort to wake up within the dream, and that's one of the things that you do is you learn to, you know, get a book in your dream and check it out. Yeah, you can't read text in a dream. That's interesting.
So what that means to me is that the times when dreams actually fool you are times when in the dream you're not being self-reflective. That as soon as you are in a dream and ask yourself, is this really happening or is this a dream? You can see that it's a dream. It's not actually that clever.
But I think...
The parallel would not... There is no real reason to think, sitting right here, maybe I'm actually dreaming. Maybe I'm in the Matrix. That is a fake doubt.
I think, though, that it's more important to establish the possibility of being in error about things and to illustrate it in various ways. So two things about this. I think dreaming, in fact, is a pretty powerful argument, despite the fact that we can wake up in them and realize it. And I still have doubts about how relevant it is that the dreaming argument be powerful anyway. What is important is that he has to establish the possibility of error, which seems obvious on one level, but it's something that's extremely, for people who are listening to this who go further into philosophy, there's a tremendous amount of philosophy that's motivated by trying to account for the possibility of error. It's sort of the wrench in every attempt to explain how we know things, or even metaphysical systems, what are the basic things in the world. Things would be a lot simpler if you didn't have to account for it, because the problem is, how is it that we have perceptions of things that aren't there, let's say, or we're wrong about things, and what does that imply? So again, I'm making this distinction between establishing the possibility of error and the nature of error through different examples, and then the strength of any particular argument. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Mark, to answer your point and to kind of sort of address what Wes just said, is that I love the argument and it's poetic to me, and it kind of gets me where I need to go as a thought experiment. But I have not personally been in a situation where, in kind of conscious or sort of like present state, I've had dreams that I couldn't distinguish from reality. There's a qualitative difference between the real or sort of the wakeful state and the dreaming state for me I don't remember dreams. I don't have very strong, like, I don't live in dreams very well. So they're very murky to me anyway.
Because you're poor of spirit. Limited imagination, inferior being.
I know. It's probably got something to do with me, you know, being from Eastern Europe. I don't know. But the one thing I can say is that in memory, there are things that I have trouble distinguishing whether they actually happened or whether I dreamt them. So there's a certain kind of clarity of experience that disappears when it becomes the past, where I can absolutely doubt, you know, I can't doubt that things have shapes and colors and things like that, but I certainly can doubt whether something actually happened, like events, or whether I dreamed it. But that's maybe a function of misspent youth. I don't know. So I love the argument and I love the process because I think he makes it very accessible and he kind of gets you. I think everybody can associate with this concept of being misled by perception or dreaming in order to get the idea that to get to the point where you're saying, okay, I can doubt, but it is still a thought exercise and not a visceral, real, to bring up your reference to the Matrix, right? By the way, I mean, I was so anxious to use, you stole my thunder by referencing The Matrix in this particular podcast.
Well, I think we should talk about that more because there is a need for this to be motivating, to have it not be just a thought experiment, but to have a real possibility. I mean, this is what you try to get people in intro philosophy class to consider, that maybe right now you are, and the version of it that we usually give in philosophy classes, you are a brain in a vat.
Yes.
I don't remember who came up with this formulation. Do you know?
Putnam.
Gratuitous
probably
name drop.
It does not matter for our purposes, but I wanted to give credit where credit
may be.
Due.
I know. He talks about it a lot.
Because it's not. I believe it was the Warshawski brothers.
Oh, shit. That's right. Not the Coen brothers did Blood Simple and the Hudsucker Proxy and all that. Big Lebowski.
Yes.
You're right.
Yes.
Sorry. My bad.
Exactly. Is this brain in a vat idea? So maybe. Even though I think I'm sitting here participating in this podcast, last year, a mad scientist broke into my house, killed me, killed my body, ripped my brain out of my body, placed it into a nice large beaker with some preserving fluid, hooked a bunch of electrodes to it, hooked it to a computer that was somewhat more advanced than most computers that are around nowadays, and since that point have been programming my experience. So I think that I'm talking, but I have no more mouth. It was long ago chopped off. I think that I'm sitting here, I have no more ass. I have no more lungs for breath. I am certainly, well, I'm hooked up to a computer, but I'm not talking to a computer in the way that I think I am now with a live microphone in front of me. Because all that is just an illusion, and the only thing I'm perceiving, that was a Doug Henning oral reference there, an illusion is what the mad scientists are pumping into my brain.
Okay, can I throw one thing out of there before we get into that? I'm going to sound like a broken record here. So I still want us to entertain, not just, so I'm going to expand this, not just the idea that it doesn't matter in the sense that you don't really, if you're doing a geometrical proposition, have to doubt the thing that you're assuming to be false. You just assume it's false in order to prove it. But in this case, that in fact, it might be the case that Descartes doesn't think it matters even in the end. In other words, do we really need to get the world back and God back? By the end of the second meditation, all we have is this little hint that in a way it doesn't matter because our certainty of self and those actual perceptions, even if they're illusions, is the critical thing. Now, Descartes treats it as a sort of means to an end to get everything back, but maybe it's just the end. In other words, it doesn't matter if I'm hooked up like the Matrix or brain in the vat.
Right.
You know,
right.
What are
and
we saying
exactly
is real? What do we
up?
Even want to say is, you know, maybe that's an even an incoherent idea. And that common sense certainty, well, you're right. We should have that certainty because it's indistinguishable from just being certain of the perception itself. I'm not saying I want us to entertain that.
Sure. I mean, I think Descartes himself, that's one of the ways his philosophy is characterized, is the quest for certainty. That's entirely the reason he's doing all this doubt, is so that all of his philosophy will be based on a certain foundation in the manner of mathematics like we were talking about before. So I think it's a, but it's I'm a going great beyond stretch that to say now. That going... maybe Descartes himself, you know, doesn't actually care about certainty, but certainly a lot of the people following him have taken that route that you're describing.
But yes. I'm saying, though, that we should entertain the idea that there's not even a coherent difference between the idea that there's something real outside. Because, and the reason why I say that is, yes, there has to be something mind independent. That's important to preserve in the sense that if we want to talk about the truth and all those things that may still be important to us, we need some sense of mind independence. But the matrix scenario and the brain in that scenario and even the evil genius scenarios, those are mind independent systems, let's say, which provide their own grounding. Even if it is to what we might want to call illusion, we're still stuck inside, let's say, a consistent system, which we can test internally as consistent, where the illusions sort of make their own internal sense, and it is grounded in something mind-independent.
If you want to say that the system is internally consistent, right, the entire reason that Descartes wants to do this is to found science, is a lot of the reason he says he wants to do this, which has a consistency, we thought, because physical objects are real, are outside of our minds, and so they're going to do the same thing every time you look at them, and experiments are going to be repeatable, and you're going to be able to make generalizations about them.
But you can do that in the Matrix scenario.
Well, you could, but you don't have to. In the actual Matrix movies, well, you have certain parts of the program that can cheat. And in fact, that's how Neo, what makes him so special is because he can cheat. He can twist the programming of the Matrix so that the normal laws that apply to physical objects don't apply to him. So that sort of undermines science if you can...
But
cheat,
only if
the laws
scientist
of science don't apply to everything.
Detects those inconsistencies, if he finds out that the atom is cheating and not doing its usual thing, which is something that happens up to this point to not be the case. This is a serious claim I'm making, which is that there is still something mind-independent. That's what science requires. But it doesn't require you that you say, oh, those mind-independent things are objects which are just like the things that we perceive.
I'll buy that, but...
Yeah, I think I understand kind of now what you're going at, Wes.
But let's discuss that later. Let's get to the spell out. The brain in the vat thing,
I think we spelled out the brain in the vat thing. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm saying the glory of the Matrix is that it just provided an amazing teaching tool for teaching this text, right? Because it essentially gives you a modern way of doing the same walk down the path that we did in the first meditation. It's like, oh well, you know, you don't have to do the whole sense argument and just say, oh, well, suppose you're, you know, one of the people in the Matrix, right? And everybody goes, oh, yeah, okay, so everything's false, but I think it's real, you know, and it kind of gets you to where you need to be. To kind of get to the point of what is Descartes trying to accomplish here, the beginning of the second meditation, he makes a reference to Archimedes, who, of course, said, give me one fixed point and I can move the world. Mm-hmm.
So I gave it to him and he didn't. Bastard.
His stick wasn't long enough. But, you know, I think that what Mark was talking about is kind of what set me off on this, that he sort of is saying, I want to establish something, some kind of first principle, some kind of indubitable doubt, and that this actually spawns multiple attempts to get at that very thing. And it goes as far as, like you said, Wes, you might doubt what the external world is, but there is something out there. Like that might be as far as you get, right? Or... You know, then people questioning whether or not there's an I or a me, but there's a thinking thing and, you know, a doubting thing.
I think maybe we should retreat to that a little bit because we jumped out to the external world, but do we think that the preliminary step is this I and this sense that we can say that we're certain of our existence? Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
Well... He uses the term deceived, right, because he's on this evil demon thing. And he says, well, deceive me as he may, he can never bring it about that I am nothing, so long as I'm conscious, right? Basically, this proposition, I am, I exist, is necessarily true each time as expressed by me or conceived in my mind. And I sort of agree with that criticism that says, well, the one thing he didn't throw away and doubt was that he could be deceived about the concept of an I and a me, and that all we can say is that something is being deceived.
Yeah, that's a common criticism now of that argument.
Let me just state the argument in a different way, okay. That he's describing the contents of his consciousness. So I have these perceptions of things. I have things I imagine. I have wishes. I have other things. And in all those, I could doubt that they refer to something external. So maybe my perception of this chair does not actually refer to a chair outside, because there could be an evil demon or a scientist plugging something into my brain that says there's a chair there, but there's really no chair there. But in all these cases, even if the thing, the referent of the thought of an external thing is not there, right? The thought itself doesn't refer to anything. Still, the thought itself is there, right? It's there as an illusion. So at least there is a reality to the perceptions themselves. And the way he wants to express this is there's a reality to his consciousness, right? So when he says, if I think, therefore I am, right? He's saying there are thoughts. And he's not really, I think, committing to himself, at least initially, that there is this being that exists over time that has the thoughts, that unifies all the thoughts or something like that. But he's saying there is a focal point to the thoughts, right?
Yeah.
That they are self-evidently my thoughts, whatever that means. And he's not committing himself at this stage to what the me, the I is at all.
Right. Mark, I think that's important. There are a few different possible strands coming from this. So what we have is that I'm in error, and the idea is to get what the implication of the error is, let's say the consciousness of error. Let's not even start with I. The I that he gets out of that, we could think of in at least two different ways. One is just as the consciousness itself. I can be certain of that consciousness. Going beyond that I can be certain that that consciousness, right, I can be certain of the consciousness that is that error, that delusion. The next step is to say that in that, I am certain of this sense of an I that goes along with it. I don't just say wrong, I say I was wrong, and we can address that too. That still doesn't commit him to this, let's say, metaphysical substance, this thinking thing that he talks about later. And that's the third way to construe it, that he gets the I as this eternal soul, this metaphysical self or substance. The fourth possibility is that the I is strongly unified, let's say, and this doesn't imply substance either. That strong unity he doesn't initially make an argument for, but he does get to that at the end. And the point he wants to make is that there is a certain kind of unity to all the different sensations I have of an object. You know, I have a sensation of its extension and its color and all those sorts of things, but there is no sense for unifying those, and I have to attribute that unification to judgment or to mind. What he's trying to say there at the end of the second meditation is that what I get out of the unity of the object is a picture of the unity of the I. The unity of the object and that aspect of experience grounds the unity of the I. So in other words, to have an error, to have a delusion, implies a certain perceptual quality or unity that further implies a unified self or I to have it. Does that make sense?
Yep, a unified thinker.
Right.
You brought up the example of the wax that's given in Meditation 2 earlier, unless you feel like jumping in, Seth, because you haven't said anything.
Wax can, I mean, Seth, I called you wax. That's an interesting Freudian slip. There is no identity. There is no Seth. You're just wax. But Seth, can you give a description of that?
Yeah, I mean, so basically he says, okay, you have this piece of wax. And when it's cool, like you've taken it off of the hive and it's cool, it has a sweet smell and it has a certain color. You know, it's white and it has a solid form and so on, right? And then if you put it near the fire, you know, some of the fluid inside evaporates. And so the smell goes away and the color changes and then it starts to melt and the form changes, right? And the way I understand the argument, what he's saying is, I still understand that that is still the same piece of wax, even though it's completely different now than it was 20 minutes ago. And that the ability to apprehend that unity in the object means that I have some kind of capability that he's calling mind that can apprehend the object independent of its sensory form, you know, its external form. And that somehow establishes the existence of this unified entity called the human mind.
And what do you think of this, even just the analysis of the wax? That is, this is the same thing, even though it's melted. I mean, to me, that actually just sounds like a faulty pre-scientific apprehension of the wax, that what you have is a certain chemical structure that has now been converted to a different chemical structure. So in fact, what you're looking at is not still the same wax, because part of that wax has drifted away, has converted to something else. And what you're looking at is the remainder. So you're not looking at the same substance. You're looking at the substance that has been broken down into something else.
But we could, strictly speaking, say that of any object, right? We exchange all our atoms, for instance, every 7 years in our bodies. And if you want to talk about strictly material conditions for identity, I think you'd have some kind of problem. Or you could say any sort of identity over time is an illusion. From a scientific standpoint.
But not in the same way, not to the same obvious extent that the changing wax after you melt it is an illusion. I mean, I take a glass. I have a glass in front of me.
But there's still some continuity. There's still an inch. Even with change, you're talking about change. That doesn't mean that there's no... An assertion that something has changed requires the concept of identity to ground it. Otherwise, you would just be talking about two entirely different unrelated phenomena. To acknowledge that one thing has led into the other is already asserting a kind of identity. So this wax is still this wax.
But he's saying that because it's so different, and yet we know it's the same thing, that you know, means something about how we apprehend physical objects. Where I would just say, if it only changes a little, like my glass changes when I move it an inch to the left, let's call it the same thing. And if I melt it down into pudding, then, you know, why not say that it's a substantially different thing? So really, don't make it more complicated than it is. He's really trying to get something, you know, saying, oh, it's like there's an essence of the thing itself that we're seeing, even though all the perceptual qualities of it change. No. I'm saying if enough perceptual qualities of it change, why don't we just call it a different thing? And in fact, you know, chemistry does call it a different thing, depending on sort of what the specifics we're looking at are.
So interestingly, I agree with both of you, even though you seem to be... contradicting each other. So I agree with Wes that this brings up the concept of identity. And that's actually kind of one of the strange things is that up until this point, identity has not been part of the argument, right? It's all been about trying to establish some indubitable fact. But the other thing is that, you know, I agree with Mark in saying that not that the thing doesn't come up, but that the argument is more about the continuity of perception that comes from his side than it is about the object. And that's the thing that's interesting, is that he's sort of assuming that his proof for the certainty of the human mind is actually predicated on the concept of continuity through time and a memory of previous things, right?
And also predicated on this quality of unity with an experience, which this particular example of the wax, substitute a better example. The point is that we don't sense the unity of the object. In other words, perception is more than just raw sense data.
Sure.
They have to be organized. There are higher cognitive functions of judgment which provide that unity. That really is the important point about the argument.
The
important conclusion of
the
argument that I think that we would agree with. That, yeah, that perception, objects don't just come to us. There's cognitive activity in perceiving things the way we do that is more than just raw, sensuous data. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can certainly say that we impose, you know, and maybe it's even to some extent an arbitrary cultural determination of what we consider to be unity of an object or not. So, for instance, if somebody dies, so they're right in front of me, they're living, and then they die. Well, it seems intuitively it's the same thing that is there. But yet, you know, there's another part of our intuition that Descartes would buy to say, no, something is fundamentally different, that, right, the life force has gone out of it, so it's fundamentally a different thing now. And whether we say, oh, you know, just go ahead, it doesn't matter what happens to the body, we can just eat it or throw it away or whatever, because what's important about it is gone, the soul or something, or whether we're... That's still him. We have to treat that body with the utmost respect, and because it's still the person. You know, that's to some extent just an arbitrary cultural matter.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, and there are lots of very tricky cases like that, especially when you get to the point of culture. But I think, and this is probably pretty common cognitively to everyone, there are a lot of basic cases where, just to take another example, when you look at an object, you have to scan it, let's say, if it's big, or pretty much any, most of the things you look at, you have to scan different parts of it and in a sense assemble it into a whole. So that assemblage is not sensory. That assemblage is something non-sensory. It's judgment, it's mind. That's the thing that Descartes wants to talk about, or anything relational, or let's say space. Space itself isn't something that's perceived, but it's structural. And so you can say that's really out there or contributed by mind in a certain way, but it's still a function of some faculty that isn't just the five senses. And that unity, I think, is something, that identity for objects is something that I don't think is dependent on culture, just very basic cognitive examples.
Well, yeah, we can divorce this for a minute from his proving that he exists and look at this particular example and the way he treats it as a response to what he was saying was the common sense way of viewing things, which is the empiricist notion that we get all of our knowledge through experience. And so he's responding to that and saying, no, in fact, we impose these very basic concepts like unity on things. You know,
right.
Though it seems like all the components that make those up are right there in our experience. If we actually look at how much something can change, and yet whether we're right or not, we still call it the same wax, the same thing, means that our minds are contributing something, and so empiricism is wrong.
And note that because that unity can't come in from the outside, because it's an imposition of the mind, that does create a problem for Descartes, where you might think you do need a God out there to sort of be the guarantor that our minds are lining up with the world in that sense. But more important than that is you could be completely deceived about those identities and those unities. What's important here to Descartes is that even if that unity is a delusion, it still is providing you with a unified I or self. The sort of implication of the unity of experience, again, is the unity of the self.
So you think he's going above and beyond his basic formulation of I think, therefore I am, which Seth read, which is at the time that I am thinking something, there is a self that is thinking it, that you're saying, because that just
I'm not saying a metaphysical substance, but I'm saying that
there is a unity over time.
A unified consciousness over time.
But I think that's why it's so natural for him to get this metaphysical substance out of that, because it's not just taken very literally that as soon as I have a thought, there's a consciousness having that thought, and then I have a thought a minute later, well, maybe it's a different consciousness having that thought. No, that there's some unity built into our experience there.
But I don't think that unity requires a thinking thing or substance. I think, and that this is one of my pet peeves sort of with a lot of contemporary criticisms of Descartes, I think those are two different elements that don't rest on each other. You could criticize the idea that we have this immediate, certain access to a unified consciousness, and then you can criticize the idea that there must be some metaphysical substance out there that provides that unity, but certainly there are other ways to think about what causes that unity.
I think what's interesting, there's kind of a throwaway comment in the sixth section of the second meditation. I'm going to read it, and it is relevant to this, I hope. He says, thinking is another attribute of the soul, and here I discover what properly belongs to myself. This alone is inseparable from me. I am, I exist. This is certain. But how often? As often as I think, for perhaps it would even happen if I should wholly cease to think that I should at the same time altogether cease to be. And to talk about this unity over time that you guys were just mentioning, he's sort of opening up the idea that I can't even be sure how often I am unified over time, that I could theoretically, you could imagine that, you know, you should sort of come into existence and think for a while and then stop and then come back in at some point and think that you had continuity in your unity, but in fact, you know, you were just being deceived again. Is that not possible?
It's funny, I highlighted that exact passage as well. I think, though, that one of the points he wants to make is that there is no distinction between thinking that you have that unity and having it. To be deceived about having that unity is to have the unity. Because what would it mean?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's not right about that. I tend to be convinced by that.
The thing that I'm driving at, Wes, is just that there's an element of time that he's not explicitly saying, but that's embedded in this whole thing, is that it's unity over time. It's, and he never explicitly says it, but it's a critical component. And that gets back to what I said about, you know, memory, the unity over time, but I can be deceived about, I can be deceived about memories of the past. I wouldn't doubt that I have a unity, but I would doubt my perception of that unity and all that, if that makes sense. And I'm just going to apologize to anybody who's already sat through an hour of this that I'm on cold medication and have had an extremely long day, and I'm just wondering if I'm even coherent.
You've been a rock star.
Please.
As usual.
You're making me blush.
A rock star like Wang Chung.
That wasn't rock. That was some other classification.
Hey, everybody, Wang Chung is... tonight. God damn it.
I think this has been a great talk. What do you guys think?
I disagree. No. I think you're assholes and we should never do this again.
I think Wes is the rock star of this particular episode so far.
Or at least the opinionated one.
To me, in some sense, this is really what philosophy is all about, right? I mean, it combines the self-reflective or the contemplative life that Wes talked about in our last episode with kind of reason and argument and assumption, a little bit of socio-political and religious connotations in the background, a little bit of biography. It's very accessible and yet gets extremely complex very quickly, right? It takes you from something very, very simple, seeming simple, to something very like fundamentally disturbing very, very quickly. It's like two pages, right? I mean, it's a phenomenal, phenomenal text.
Utterly baffling, really. Once you get into the meat of it and concepts of identity, for instance, it's just that's something to spend the rest of your life thinking about in complete futility, but, you know, pleasurable futility.
And Mark, I want to, you know, as a candidate for topics in the future, definitely we should try to find something good about identity and identity over time.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's just a fascinating, fascinating subject.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Have we reached the end of, at least it seems we've reached the end of the second meditation in terms of our analysis, and we're not going to go too much farther into the actual text, right?
The one thing we can say is that this is not the text where he actually says cogito ergo sum, right? This is kind of where the idea comes up, but he doesn't explicitly say that. That's said somewhere else, but this is kind of explains the whole thing.
Yeah, he does that in Discourse.
Discourse.
On Method.
Here he just says, I am, I exist. You already read that quote. That's the quote he comes to it.
And by the way, that argument, he's gotten that from another medieval theologian who I'm not going to name unless Mark gives
all
me
stolen.
Permission.
So he's like,
all right, I'm going to name them. The first argument is St. Augustine, and the second is St. Anselm, which I don't think is as lame as Mark thinks, by the way, because there's a lot of interesting
logic we're that went into disproving. Exactly on those guys.
Are we going to have a medieval Judeo-Christian throwdown?
I think let's
combine it all in one if we have to have it at all.
We should all have to wear medieval garb. And we should all talk in Old English or Latin, preferably.
Latin or Greek, right?
We should all talk to each other when we're making humorous asides in Old English, but then quote the text in Latin.
Well, listen, and, if we do that, you know I'm bringing Spinoza to the table.
And if anybody says anything heretical, then, well, I can't burn you at the stake because you're over there in Austin or Boston, but you have to burn yourself at the stake.
There's actually an online service for burning people at the stake conveniently from the comfort of your own home.
You upload a photo or something? What is it?
No, it's real. It'll really burn them. It's
Okay, so do we need to
give the link?
A couple things. One thing is there is a movie or a documentary or something called Philosophy in the Matrix.
There's a book.
Well, no, there's clips from the movie or from some kind of video on YouTube. And they actually interview eminent philosophers and ask them to talk about the Matrix. And they talk about all the various different types of Descartes being one of them and Kant and a few other folks and how the Matrix explores concepts that were near and dear to these guys' hearts.
Very cool. Let's put that on the website as well.
And then I feel like, Mark, we need to have kind of a sum up if we are going to end here.
You know, before, I don't think we need to end quite yet, because I think we should say a little about some of the major things that Descartes comes away with this with. He uses this methodological doubt really to found science and to get back all the things he believed in the first place, but with a different epistemological theory of knowledge importance. Whereas before we might have thought that the physical objects are the most obvious, indubitable things. Now he thinks that, you know, my sense of myself and in fact mathematical facts and things are more indubitable, and that the physical objects, yeah, okay, we're sure that they're there, and other people, we didn't even talk about this at all yet, that other people, the only reason that we're sure they're there is because God makes us think that they're there, and he's just not such a dick that he would be lying to us all the time about that kind of stuff. So, you know, so there's a certain reordering, and he does get something of an ontology out of this, right? This sort of list of things that exist and how they exist that divides the realm of mind, which includes us and includes God, probably, versus all the physical things, the extension, right? So the things of the body, the things in the physical world are characterized by extension, which means you can always cut them into smaller pieces, whereas he thinks the mind, minds are unities, and you can't cut them into pieces. And we've already talked a little about how that doesn't seem to follow from what he's said so far. Just because I perceive this unity, well, does that really mean that there's eternal souls, that the mind is this thinking thing, that even if the body dies away, it'll keep going? I mean, he sort of thinks it's a logical extension of what he was saying before, but there's some pretty obvious leaps there that we don't have time to go into all his justifications that he gives in other works or even in this work.
That's a really good, there's two interesting points about what you said. One is that there's really no reference to other people, and that in a lot of ways, in a lot of other philosophical works, particularly later on, the concept of other thinking things actually poses a huge problem. He doesn't even concern himself with the fact that there's going to be a million things out there that are all certain of themselves and not of each other, or less certain of each other than they are of themselves. And then the second thing is, it's somewhat ironic that he started off saying that he needed to come up with an indisputable proof for the existence of God to tell infidels. But the fixed point that he's going to use to prove the existence of God is actually the existence of himself. And he's going to leave it up to everyone else to find their own self-certainty in order to find God, which is kind of a really bizarre and funny thing.
I think we need to at least characterize his argument for the existence of God without arguing about it just now, because I'm sure people are on the edges of their seats and are immediately going to look this up on the internet if we don't tell them right now. So he's proven in the Second Meditations that he exists, right? There is a mind. So the way he proves God is just by the character of his idea of God, right? We can be certain that there are ideas in your head. There are ideas in your head of physical objects. One of these ideas in my head is about God. And the idea of God is very special, such that it implies that there really is a God. And I don't think we have to even give any more, right? I don't even want to go in any more detail than that, but it's just something about the character of the idea itself.
The idea
as it presents itself.
The thing
cannot be caused. The idea is that it has to be caused by something. If you have an idea of something perfect, it has to be caused by
a perfect
something with those qualities.
Right. It's the same thing with infinity. How could I get the idea of infinity in my head unless infinity is real out there in the world? And I don't want to talk about that anymore. Otherwise, I'll get furious. I think we should save that for another
it's
podcast.
It's not. Do you know how the argument is refuted?
I don't even want to talk about it right now.
It requires
I'm going to hold my ears and go, la, 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 la.
It requires modern propositional logic. It's unrefutable prior to Frege and I just dropped some names. It requires a kind of logic that wasn't developed until the 19th century, seriously.
So in other words, it was a false argument until the 19th century, and then it became true.
Exactly. I mean, we can agree to disagree about that. I mean, I think that to me is a small part of
I
the overall thing.
I think we should
disagree. The argument itself, the assumption.
I think we should agree to disagree to agree to disagree.
Now, I think the overall sketch of assuming that we're in error about everything in order to derive some sort of foundational certainty, I think that's it's sort of the wellspring of everything that happens in philosophy afterwards, although I suppose you could say that about any major philosopher at any given time.
Well, that's a compliment of it, and it's also a criticism that I've heard of it, that philosophers got so entranced by this project of doubt, whereas nowadays you really should be looking first, is anything real motivating this doubt? Is there any real possibility that we are in the Matrix? And we already talked about actually how the Matrix, right? In the Matrix, there are actual other people, right? That they're also plugged into the Matrix. So that makes it a fundamentally different kind of argument from the brain in the vat, where it's just me plugged in. Because, right, maybe, you know, you wouldn't like to be a brain in the vat because it's just all illusory, all these relationships you think you're having with people. Where at least in the Matrix, even if the chair is not real, these are actual other people that you are in love with and stuff. And so maybe that's all we need as far as meaning goes.
See, again, I disagree with the idea, this criticism about motivations for doubt. I think there are a lot of good motivations for skepticism.
Blanket skepticism? I would say that's something that's driven philosophers crazy and made them consider things that do not matter for actual life, and why philosophy students are so quick to dismiss philosophy completely, because they say, really? No. You're going to seriously entertain the idea that this chair isn't there?
Yes, that's just dumb. Yes about everything. No, but yes about everything in the strict sense, in the sense that, take for instance, Maxwell, famous scientist, developed equations for the propagation of light. Those equations are very useful. And you might, or let's say Newton's, you know, laws of motion, and those are in some senses rock solid scientific propositions, and you can use them to do lots of things. But strictly speaking, they're false, because Einstein comes along and modifies both of those. The Maxwell's equations were modified in a way that makes little difference unless you're in special circumstances. But we have reason to believe that those modifications are always going to continue. And we have also reason to believe that, especially as we get into quantum mechanics, that we're really not going to achieve any adequate foundation, and that there are good reasons to think that every scientific proposition, strictly speaking, is false. It may approximate in some sense. It may be useful. So I think there's lots of reasons to motivate that skepticism.
Saying that scientific theories are universalizations, right? They're generalization. They're saying in all circumstances something happens, and, you know, we discover the limits of a scientific theory, like Newton's law of motion, because we discover some conditions under which, oh, well, that's not the conditions we were thinking of when we came up with this generalization. But those are about generalizations. Those are about these universal claims, whereas doubting everything means not that you doubt just the universal claims, just the scientific claims that purport to be universal, but you doubt the individual claims that come at you in your experience.
But there are good reasons to doubt, let's say, the existence of objects in the naive realist sense, or that things are exactly as we perceive. And even a cognitive scientist, even someone in working on the brain and how the brain processes things, just getting into that stuff, you'd begin to doubt whether or not things are as we perceive them, or what it means to be an object. And again, those questions of identity. But again, I think the larger point is that Descartes isn't really worried about whether things outside of him exist. I don't think that is the most important part of it. And I think methodological doubt is extremely important, because, again, the point is that you're assuming what you want to disprove. It's a common mathematical technique, and it leads somewhere.
Mark, I want to acknowledge what you're saying, but I also kind of want to, at the same time,
make it stop.
Say something very positive about the text, you know, and that's that the criticism that you mention about, does it even make sense to go through this activity, and is it somehow counterproductive? I think it makes sense to maybe make that kind of a criticism from where we sit now. But the fact that this small little text and maybe some of his other writings essentially dictated the course of Western thought for the next, you know, 200 or 250 years, because there's a whole chain of thinkers that come after are essentially just responding to him and then responding to the respondents of him and all that, indicate that he touched on something fundamental. And maybe it was just something that's fundamental to a perverse subset of the human species that called themselves philosophers or what have you. But, you know, those are names that persist through time and have a tremendous impact on us, and that at some point in time we may end up touching on, you know, I mean, Kant and Hegel and Husserl, right, and all of these guys. And to me, there's just a tremendous amount of value in what he did for all the reasons, good and bad, and that, you know, I'm just happy that somebody had the courage to undertake this activity, in the same way that there are probably a lot of people who look at, you know, certain art movements, let's say modern art, you know, at the turn of the century or what have you, and go, what the hell was that all about, right? Like, it was counterproductive to have abstract form or to do this kind of thing with color or what have you. But even if it becomes a historical relic, if it has some impact and sort of takes human experience and knowledge and thought and all this stuff in a different direction, then it has some kind of value. Slash rant, soapbox down.
Look, I'm not going to deny the historical value of this or that, you know, I do think this is a great way, like we were talking about in the last podcast, of starting on your process of getting past the unexamined life, of trying to do this as an exercise. And if Wes is correct that this is, you know, largely supposed to be, you know, something that you do, as Descartes describes it, once, then that's fine. But the historical upshot of this has been that a lot of folks who don't buy the end parts of the meditation and either his argument for the existence of God or any substitute argument that you could put in at that point that would complete the rest of the chain and get you out of the cycle of doubt, then that leads to an extreme skepticism about everything that undermines, that becomes nihilism, that has in a lot of historical forms become that you have to take things on faith, or there's really no ultimate grounding for values. Everything just looks different for everybody and looks different to different cultures. And it's really led to a degradation. It's led to some needless confusion, I think.
But I don't think that's uniquely his fault. I think that's been around forever. He's just the modern incarnation of going through this exercise.
I strongly disagree. Because, first of all, skepticism and relativism, we have to make sure we distinguish those two. There is a sort of pernicious relativism that can come out of that. But I think, in fact, they're mutually inconsistent.
Right.
The other thing is, I don't think that...
It's going to be hard to respond.
I know you are. I don't think that the kinds of things we get, and, you know, Seth mentioned Kant and Hegel and the rest, the people who don't buy the getting the world back thing in some form or another, I don't think that they're motivated by simple gratuitous skepticism. It's sort of like they're not descendants of Descartes, but they're cousins. And I think a lot of what motivates Cartesian doubt is modern developments in science. You know, they began to realize, oh, look, if you're beginning to describe the world mathematically, and if you say to yourself, if you start studying optics, as Descartes did and a lot of these guys did, and you say, oh, colors aren't really colors, they're just waves going into the eye. Those are strong reasons for skepticism, and those, I think, are the real roots of all that.
Well, let me ask you, because you were talking about this before, that, you know, we have this naive, realistic view of the thing in front of me, this desk, is solid. But then we do some scientific analysis of it, and we find, oh, it's not solid. It's actually a bunch of little particles with big spaces between them. Do you think that that shows that the naive realist is wrong?
No, not that particular. So here's a way you might, for instance, challenge naive realism. If you say that, let's just take a very simple example, and you say, well, are colors really out there, or are they merely internal qualitative experiences that are products of the interaction between the brain and something outside of it? Now, this becomes a very complex and also hopeless problem, but it's still a problem. And the point is that there's the very real possibility that if you're a naive realist in the sense that you think, oh, something is red, and that means there's this external thing red, and that's challenged by the idea that, in fact, waves are bouncing off of objects, which inherently, you know, that qualitative experience has only to do with your relationship to the object and the kind of thing that the brain is doing, let's say, or that the mind is doing in constructing the object, let's say. So the point of going beyond naive realism standpoint is not to deny common sense in the sense of its doubt that, let's say, there are things outside of us in the most obvious sense, but it's to get into the meat of what that means and the contributions of the subject to that. And does that make sense?
Well,
or is that...
Right. I think you're... When you say this is in any way a refutation of naive realism, you're making naive realism really less naive than it is. That I would say we have an experience of an object before us, which is a very practical, pragmatic experience, such that I think if I put my keys down here, then if
right.
I come back later, they'll still be there.
But no one is and challenging those pragmatic,
well, but that's,
that pragmatic
that's
approach.
What, that's, I think, at least a very common interpretation. Maybe the smartest philosophers did not interpret it this way, but if you set philosophy students loose on Descartes and they take him really seriously and think like there's a real reason to doubt everything, that we really can't be sure of anything and have this, you know, actual skepticism about everything, that it's groundless and it's needlessly corrosive.
Okay.
Are you a Republican?
Can I make a recommendation that we turn that into a topic maybe for a future cast?
Sure.
Well, because we wanted to say the topic of this podcast is not just Descartes' first and second meditations, but it has to be a question. So the question I put was, what can I know? And I know we haven't really, there's a whole history of epistemology that tries to answer that question, but we had to at least start that. And, you know, Descartes did really get the modern philosophers going on this whole question in the way that we
have. And I think it's more than historical value, by the way. I'm going to maintain my position as the complete Descartes apologist. I think that his argument is extremely strong and it has huge implications. So I'm a Kantian. What can I say?
Okay, that was your closeout. I will say that I think this quest for certainty that really drives the whole thing is misguided and unnecessary, that we don't need certainty for almost any reason. I mean, maybe if you think it ultimately we need it for religious reasons, and maybe you think that was ultimately what was motivating him. And, you know, maybe we can't have that kind of certainty. And maybe I'm not ultimately that different from a Kantian or your position when you come down to it. But the way I would like to phrase it is that the kind of doubt has introduced needless confusion.
All right. I agree. I agree in the sense that I don't think certainty is nearly as important as everybody else does. I just think that to me, in many ways, this is absolutely the prototypical philosophical text, and that if there's anybody in philosophy who does more with less, who typifies what the activity is all about and simultaneously generates as much debate, thought, confusion, interest, and all that in so few words, I would like them to show it to me, because I think this is pretty much it. And I believe it's poetic in places, and so I'll leave it at that. But ultimately, I'm a Heideggerian. If you're a Kantian, I'm a Heideggerian. Truth, I have a different relationship to truth than
just
other people.
Just means you've gotten farther historically than me.
Yeah, but geographically, not very far.
Still working my way towards.
If you're looking for a clear and more influential philosopher than this, I will just refer you to The Tao of Marmaduke by Hieronymus T. Nice job. One more time.
You've brought us full circle, Mark.
Yes, you have.
And that sounds like a good time to talk about next week.
All right.
For next week, we're going to read Hobbes' Leviathan, chapters 13 to 15, and I will warn the listener that they are a bear and you should probably just skim it. And maybe look up Hobbes. Look up Hobbes on Wikipedia.
Well, tell them,
really
tell them
that,
the important
that
things,
influence, man.
The important
tell
things
them,
are in there.
Tell them why you want to read it. What's the key phrase that? What's the magic of these particular chapters in Hobbes?
The social contract that he came up with, this notion. The question for next week will be: is there a social contract, you know, some deal that we have made just implicitly by being part of society that makes us have to obey certain laws? Right. And that's the what he uses to ground it, because without society, life is
nasty, brutish, and short.
So there you go. So look for those parts. And if you get too lost in the thicket of horrible fake geometry, fake algebra terminology that he gives, then look on Wikipedia or some other Cliff Notes-like source to get a picture.
Or look for the poetry.
Do you think there's poetry in Hobbes?
As in
Seth's the way that
approach.
There is in this? I would say Descartes is beautifully sculpted, served up to the reader with a nice bow and some pudding, in a way that Hobbes is an old moldy fish served on a plate of poison. and some rat skeletons.
Please make it more attractive. Can you do that? Do you have anything else you can do?
Well, if there's any poetry there, it's to make the text itself like the state of nature.
Yes. I will find beauty in this text if it kills me. just because now I feel I have to set myself up in opposition to Linsenmeyer on everything. All right.
All right. Thank you and good night to everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Start now. Cough me up and brush me off and mean it. If it's a new time, then treat it as such. It doesn't matter that much if you believe it. And if misery is axiomatic for the likes of you and me, decide it's cool and call it fuel and use it sparingly. Choose now, down or up, just pick a ride and mean it. If it's a nosedive, then aim your luck to brush the ground and clean it. And if misery stands like a tree, looking solid as can be, let's call it good and worth that wood to burn us sparingly. It's